This is Functional Medicine Update for November 2006, Volume 26, Number 11. Our subject of discussion this month is gastrointestinal inflammation. We'll begin with response to a question on the use of vitamin D for colorectal cancer, followed by a segment on diverticulosis. We will ask if probiotic supplementation use in diverticular patients is beneficial or is contraindicated. From there, we'll move to the subject of inflammatory disorders and discuss early biomarkers for autoimmunity, and then have a segment on elevated CRP and other biomarkers of inflammation. This is followed by an evolving strategy for regulating autoimmune function. Our interview this month will be with researcher Dr. John J. Bright. We'll be discussing the targeting of autoimmune function through nutraceuticals. Now, here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland.
Welcome to Functional Medicine Update for November 2006. And as you know, we are very frequently asked questions about some of the topics that we discuss and how these may relate clinically. And one of the questions that has come up recently from a number of listeners has to do with this vitamin D, calcium, magnesium connection to the whole gut function and colorectal cancer risk, and some of the things that are in the news recently. And people have asked questions about how does this work and is this clinically relevant and how much calcium, magnesium, and or vitamin D might be useful. And I think to introduce the response that I'd like to provide for that, I'd like to go to an article that appeared recently in 2005 in the Journal of Steroid Biochemistry and Molecular Biology, which is entitled, and this sounds like a functional medicine title, The Vitamin D Endocrine System of the Gut, Its Possible Role in Colorectal Cancer Prevention. And I think, as we all know, the gut represents the seat of the immune system. Over 50% of the immune system is clustered around the gut, the gut-associated lymphoid tissue. 70% of the antibodies are produced by the gut-associated lymphoid tissue. So it's a very rich site of immune function. And as you probably recognize, it has a lot of receptors on the surface of the mucosal cells of the gut, which then pick up messages and translate those messages to the rest of the body through cell signaling processes, through cytokines and chemokines and other regulatory molecules. Well, we know that vitamin D plays a role in this signaling at the gut level because there are receptors for vitamin D and the ability of the colon cells, the mucosal cells themselves, to convert vitamin D into 1,25-dihydroxy-D3, the active metabolite, hormonal metabolite of vitamin D, just like the kidney does, so does the gut mucosa. It's interesting, if you take colonocytes in the laboratory and grow them, that you can show they possess vitamin D synthesizing cytochrome P450-27B1, which produces 1,25-dihydroxy-D3, and also they have the activity of cytochrome P450-24 hydroxylases, which are the catabolic enzymes that break down 1,25-hydroxy. So it's a dynamic equilibrium between production in the gut and breakdown in the gut. Well, it turns out that a low calcium diet upregulates the expression in the gut mucosa of the cytochrome P450-24 hydroxylases that are the catabolic enzymes that break down 1,25-hydroxy-D3. So it tends to lower the activity of the hormonal form. The hormonal form of vitamin D is a very important agonist for a number of cell signaling processes that relate to the regulation of insulin signaling, the regulation of inflammation signaling, the regulation of cell proliferation and cell cycling. So if you increase the breakdown of 1,25-dihydroxy-D3 signaling, it increases cellular proliferation, decreases differentiation, and decreases some of the cell regulatory processes that occur under proper immune balance. And that occurs when your diet is shifted towards what? Low vitamin D and low calcium. So as people take away dietary calcium and or take away vitamin D through either the absence of sunlight exposure or vitamin D in their foods, then it tends to shift these cell signaling processes towards altered gut immune function and increase cellular proliferation both locally and systemically. Now, this raises a question, doesn't it, about the Oriental diet that was not a dairy product consuming diet. And historically, we know it's a very low calcium diet. So we say, well, how in the world then did you have such low incidence of colorectal cancer in Asian communities when they weren't eating a lot of calcium in their diet and they weren't taking a lot of vitamin D? It's a northern latitude population, and you might not expect they're getting a lot of sunlight exposure. Well, that's a very interesting story because recently it's been identified in a number of interesting papers that soy isoflavones are activators of the hydroxylase, the CYP27B1, that promotes in the gut mucosa the formation of 1,25-dihydroxy-D3. So you can get through the combination of calcium and isoflavones a very beneficial effect on this synthesis and the prevention of accelerated breakdown of the hormonal form of vitamin D locally, regionally, in the gut mucosa. So now we start looking at epidemiological cultural variations in the diet and the influence that has in on cell signaling. Now you might say, well, gee whiz, is this like an example of coevolution, that we evolved by natural selection over millions of years the ability to accommodate these low diets, so we use different signaling molecules to produce these salutary beneficial effects on regulatory influence on the immune system? Obviously, I don't have a crystal ball, but it sounds like a reasonable explanation. What we do know epidemiologically, however, is that diets that are high in soy isoflavones or higher in isoflavones and lower in calcium seem to have a similar beneficial effect on regulating epithelial differentiation in the colon colonocyte as does a diet that's higher in calcium and vitamin D. So this might account for differences in dairy product consuming individuals with higher calcium versus low dairy product consuming individuals who have higher isoflavone intake. Now, if you take soy out of the diet or other isoflavone-rich foods and you take calcium out of the diet, now you have, you know, a double-barrel problem because you're not upregulating the synthesis of 1,25 at the colonic level and you're increasing the breakdown. So you can shift this towards proliferation, dedifferentiation, and poor regulation. So that's the story that's starting to emerge from these observations. And there's a very interesting takeaway, obviously, about this concerning the relationship of nutrients, bioactive compounds in our food, and cell signaling, and how it regulates then gene expression patterns, because we're not talking about changing the genes. We're talking about changing the expression of those genes in polymorphic genes that then regulates the phenotype of those cells. So it's an environmental modulator, not something you're just born hardwired to get colon cancer. Now, there may be people that are more susceptible based upon their polymorphisms to this, and they may be the early warning features of the population, but it can be seen as a variable that penetrates through all the genotypes. It's a modifier with different levels of sensitivity. So if we take that model and ask how many papers have been published on this, or am I just making this up as I go, the answer is a number of different, very interesting papers, including one recent one in Nutrition Cancer, a journal, volume 55, page 35 in 2006, entitled Vitamin D Receptor Gene Polymorphisms, Dietary Promotion of Insulin Resistance in Colon and Rectal Cancer, because it turns out that there is a interrelationship between insulin resistance, a downregulation of the signaling of vitamin D, active hormonal metabolite formation, and then this dedifferentiation of colonocyte cells and increased oncogenic risk. And you're going to hear more about that as we move into the discussion in this month's body of the Function Medicine Update. So again, we shouldn't leave other conditions out of this. This is a complex web. As we know, insulin resistance plays a role, genetic polymorphisms plays a role, dietary calcium play a role, sunlight exposure plays a role, many different variables, and of course then exposure to environmental in situ carcinogens produced either by gut fermentation or direct intake. So it's a complex gene-environment interaction example. So nutritional regulation of vitamin D hydroxylase expression has potential applications in both tumor prevention and therapy. This is a very interesting paper that was actually just published in Future in Oncology, volume 3, page 415 in 2005, that again discusses this whole mechanism that I've been describing to you. So I think this is an emerging, interesting story about calcium, vitamin D, and then we'd add magnesium to that story from the discussion we had in the October issue, because magnesium is a very critically important agonist for the calcium dynamics at the cellular membrane and some of the effects that it has also on the enzyme activity of these hydroxylase enzymes forming 1,25-dihydroxy-D3. And you just reflect back to our October issue, where I was discussing these roles of magnesium in these processes. So calcium, magnesium, vitamin D. So then you might ask, well, do we need supplementation? And I guess the answer really comes from a diet evaluation. Is the patient consuming adequate levels of these nutrients or exposed to sunlight in an adequate way, or do they need augmentation? And if so, then we might start talking again about 1,000 IUs of vitamin D as a promoter for function. We might talk about soy isoflavones from a soy meal enhanced diet, one or two portion sizes a day of soy isoflavones, 20 to 30 milligrams a day from the diet. We might talk about that of calcium in the range of 1,000 to 1,200 milligrams, and obviously then lastly magnesium, as we discussed last month, 400 to 500 milligrams elemental magnesium in a non-GI irritant forms. So those are kinds of the ranges of therapeutic intervention that you might consider if a patient really has evidence of compromised status relative to those nutrients that help regulate gut immune function and then have extra GI function in terms of immunological regulation through these cell signaling pathways, the cytokines, chemokines, and intracellular communication agents. So I hope that that started us down the road in getting into this topic this month. And because we're on the gut here for a moment, let me just take a little sidebar, which is related to one of the most significant gut inflammatory conditions that we're seeing with high prevalence in our population. In fact, it's one of the most common afflictions in Western countries, and I'm talking about diverticulosis. Diverticulosis, as you know, is so common that its presence is more normal than its absence among older Americans. So we might say, what is usual? And maybe diverticulosis is normal. I don't think we consider that optimal, but that's the way people are as a consequence, primarily as what is acknowledged a low-fiber diet. And by the way, fiber is more than just a physiomechanical effect upon the gut mucosa like a scouring pad that wipes the villi clean. It is, as you know, able to be fermented by various types of microbiota that lives in the colon, and that then produces secondary atrophic factors that can have favorable influence on the physiology of the colon, one of which is butyrate, you know, a colonocyte fuel. We should think of fiber, really, or the appropriate types of fiber, as a precursor for proper formation and function of gut anatomy and physiology. As with other gastrointestinal symptoms like hiatal hernia, many symptoms are attributed, rightly or wrongly, to diverticulosis. We know that there are two very real complications of diverticulosis that can carry serious consequences, diverticulitis and diverticular hemorrhage. Diverticular disease and diverticulitis in particular are problematic because they can exist as abscesses of the colon and create chronic sites of infection, a focal infection, and obviously it can lead to perforation and very serious problems of sepsis, which has a problematic outcome even under the best of care. I think there's about a 7 to 11% mortality in people that have abscess and perforation as a consequence of diverticulitis. So this is not to be taken lightly. These are serious considerations. Generally, the medical treatment for diverticulitis is bowel rest and total parenteral nutrition, and then later probiotics and prebiotics for improving gut flora. So you generally see a patient go on a high antibiotic regime, which is a combination of antibiotics and antibacterial agents, broad spectrum. They're on bowel rest, which generally means TPN. This is 2 to 3 weeks generally, sometimes as much as 2 months, depending upon the degree of inflammation of the gut. And then from the rest and the recovery, the GI specialist and or surgeon will evaluate whether the patient is a candidate for surgery. Hopefully there's a resolution of the problem without the need for surgery, because if surgery occurs, it's generally a two-step surgery, as you know. First is a colostomy to allow cleaning up of the environment and a cooling off, and then a reconnection of the GI tract afterwards. So it's generally a pretty invasive process requiring two surgeries if everything goes right. So the attempt conservatively is to first allow the bowel to heal by intervention with bowel rest and antibiotics, and then coming back with a diet that hopefully renourishes the colon and uses a higher fiber and more friendly bacteria. Now, the question you might ask about the use of probiotics is that really a good idea when you've got potential abscess, might even be a perforating abscess of the colon? And gee whiz, what happens if you add bacteria to the gut? Aren't you running the risk of potential sepsis and infection? And this has actually been recently reviewed in 2006 in a very nice review article, Probiotic Use in Clinical Practice, What Are the Risks is the name of this paper. And this appeared in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, Volume 83, page 1256 in 2006. I would encourage those of you who are probiotic users that you might want to take a look at this article, because I think it does a very nice job of reviewing the literature. But I'll give you a quick appraisal of it if you don't have access to the article. What they go on to say is that if you review all the papers that have been published, and they try to do kind of a meta-analysis of looking at different strains of Lactobacillus acidophilus, looking at bifidobacterial supplementation, Lactobacillus reuteri, even Saccharomyces boulardii, all of these various types of probiotic organisms. So they look at cases of bacterial sepsis temporarily related to probiotic use in humans. So what is the history that we would have even any concern? And they cite 6 different studies that have been published that go back over the last 10 years, which are case reports of potential septic disorders that were associated with the administration of probiotics. And these include liver abscess, endocarditis, bacteremia is the most common. And these were using various kinds of lactobacillus GG and bacillus subtilis. The most common one probably is lactobacillus GG that was associated with four of these six reports. I need to emphasize, as they emphasize in the review, that these are not proven to be necessarily a consequence of the probiotics. So these were sick patients that had perforated bowels and they had all sorts of other things going on. But because they were also supplemented with bacteria and they were able to culture their blood and find these probiotic organisms in their blood, there is some suggestion that it was a contributor. So the watchword that they take away is if a person has a serious gut inflammation with perforation, be somewhat cautious in the inflammatory stage about the use of probiotics. They then go on to look at cases of fungal sepsis temporary related to probiotic use. And here the list is longer, the number of case histories, and it's principally associated with Saccharomyces boulardii. There are over 20 case reports in this case of S. boulardii being associated with fungemia and fungemic shock. So again, I think just as a watchword, as they try to point out, we consider these safe organisms to be used for re-inoculation of the bowel, but in cases where the individual is immune compromised, because in many of these case reports were people with perforation of the bowel in combination with HIV infection, so these were immune compromised patients or very much older patients, patients that might have been in the intensive care unit, that these are extreme examples maybe of immune compromise and sensitivity to any kind of burden of foreign organisms that are not normal. So I think I want to put this without, you know, raising too big of a red flag, just as a watchword for thought, because we recognize that these probiotics often have a very beneficial effect on gut inflammation, and they can be used and have been proven in a number of studies to be able to lower gut inflammation when used appropriately. And there are way more studies published in the literature with human intervention showing favorable effects of probiotic supplementation with chronic gut inflammation than there are these atypical examples that I've described with regard to association with sepsis or bacteremia or fungemia. Again, I think the concept here is that nothing is completely safe. I mean, when we get up in the morning, we don't have a safe profile for the day that we can say 100% is safe that we just get up and move around our world. There's always some risk just to living, to breathing, to drinking. But in a relative risk-benefit, it appears as if probiotics in certainly the earlier stages of non-perforating diverticulitis is beneficial in the remission of the disease. And in fact, there are many good reports about this, including a recent paper that appeared in the Journal of Gastroenterology. This is the World Journal of Gastroenterology, Volume 12, page 3225 in 2006, entitled Management of Diverticular Disease is Changing, in which they talk in a very strong advocacy about the use of probiotics as part of the therapy after bowel rest and antibiotics for the management of diverticulitis. So everything in balance, I guess, is always the watchword, and just keeping in the back of our mind as to what the state of the dysfunction or pathology is of the patient when we use probiotic supplements. Well, what we're really speaking to here is an interesting connection, obviously, to inflammatory disorders. And that's going to be the theme that we're going to go on to throughout the rest of this month's functional medicine update, with specific focus on modulation of autoimmune disease. And I'm very intrigued with this story that you will hear emerge, because part of the clinical concern we have about this relates to what are the biomarkers that we evaluate in a patient to identify whether they have early incipient inflammatory disorders prior to joint disfigurement, renal failure, carditis, some of the more acute symptomatologies that develop with autoimmune tissue-specific reactions and inflammation. It doesn't take very high level of diagnostic acumen to recognize an arthritidy when it's deforming. But well before that is a sequence of events that are occurring at the cellular function level with imbalances of the immune system that over maybe decades can result in ultimately deformation and the serious pathophysiology associated with autoimmunity. So what are the earlier stage markers that we might clinically evaluate? And that's a question that I wish I could give you a definitive answer, because as you know, that's a question in flux, because what we're really talking about is biomarker development for early stage recognition of inflammatory disorders. Now, as you probably know, Paul Ridker has certainly helped us to understand some of this in greater detail when he and his colleagues at Harvard got us to think about high-sensitivity C-reactive protein, because that is an example of a biomarker that's used for earlier warning recognition of potential incipient or smoldering inflammation. But as we learn more about inflammation, we recognize that it's much more than just a marker called CRP. There are literally hundreds of differing signaling molecules that give rise to an understanding of alteration of the immune system that may express itself as an inflammatory disorder. And downstream of that, ultimately, comes the production by the liver of C-reactive protein. So it's not probably what's going to be the be-all and end-all for evaluating tissue-specific inflammatory dysfunctions that occur at early stage. So let me speak briefly about biomarkers, because this is a theme and a term that we're going to be talking much more about over the years to come, because the development of good, accurate, and respected biomarkers will really be the linchpin upon which the future of functional medicine rests. In the absence of good biomarkers, we can speak philosophically all we want about early stages of disorders and precursor markers and antecedents and triggers and mediators, but the clinician doesn't know really what to do. It just sounds like an interesting philosophical exercise. Well, what do I look for in my patient? Well, exactly how do I know if they have an early precursor marker? How do I know if their genotype is expressing itself as a inflammatory phenotype that later will be a disease if I don't have something that I can measure and evaluate and track that patient against? So biomarkers become a very important thing, and that's the sensitivity, precision, and accuracy of a biomarker with clinical specificity towards the condition that it's heading towards that gives us reliability in the way we would assess and intervene and then track the success of therapy. Now, serum cholesterol would be considered a biomarker because it's really not a measurement of pathology for any disease. If you are asked the question, what disease do you diagnose with elevated cholesterol? The answer is, well, really none. It's a prognostic marker. It's a biomarker for a trajectory of physiological function heading towards a disease, cerebrovascular disease, cardiovascular disease, and so forth. So we have started down the biomarker road by including cholesterol in the standard SMAC test, the multiphasic screening laboratory analysis. But clearly, cholesterol represents a pretty broad brush type of biomarker, and there must be other individualized biomarkers in the sea of new genomic markers that are being discovered that would give better specificity and able to identify personalized need of the patient. So biomarkers are really part and parcel, part of the development of personalized medicine. The journal Genome Technology, there was a very nice review paper on biomarkers on the horizon, and the title of this is Betting on Biomarkers, Researchers Aim for the Clinic, because this is where the clinical laboratory is starting to focus some of its new attention to endorse and incorporate some of these new biomarkers. Biomarkers are central, as I said, to personalized medicine, but they're slowly trickling into clinical trials. And therefore, there is some concern that although research is discovering new potential biomarkers, that they're not being put to clinical tests. So we have kind of a block, a dam at this point. They're not getting out into clinical evaluation adequately to help spur the development of personalized medicine forward. We know, however, that there is a great impetus to develop biomarkers, and in fact, the pharmaceutical companies need better biomarkers for tracking some of their new individualized drugs, like kinase inhibitors for cancer treatment, that are more based upon the individual tumor type of the patient. If we looked at biomarkers, we could really break them down into different categories. The first would be diagnostic biomarkers that differentiate a healthy from a specific disease state. The second, which for functional medicine devotees are probably the most important family of biomarkers, and these are what we call prognostic biomarkers. Prognostic biomarkers are those that predict the likely course of disease, and here we look at expression analysis, epidemiological studies, and mechanism of disease, which is really what functional medicine has tried to focus on, is those areas. How do genes get expressed? What environments alter gene expression? How does that track against epidemiological studies so that we see it has some real effects in human populations? And then what is the mechanism of disease that cuts across ICD-9 codes and really talks about the origin of the disease? And what are the biomarkers that will help prognose the trajectory towards that disease? And this is the area probably we're most concerned about from a functional medicine perspective because it correlates with clinical outcome very closely. CRP is one of those types of trajectory markers that helps us to understand maybe the course of later disease by early warning recognition of a smoldering inflammation that we think of with a elevated high-sensitivity CRP. So in the course of our discussion in Functional Medicine Update over the next year, you're going to hear me speak much more about where is biomarker development going in the field of functional medicine. What are some of the candidates that we might start to think of as players that would help to identify personalized needs? Now, one of those biomarkers related to inflammation that has emerged to be very interesting is activity of the inflammatory cytokines that include things like interleukin-1, interleukin-2, interleukin-6, tumor necrosis factor alpha. We've all heard these names many, many times. These are proteins that are produced by components of the immune system or inflamed arteries that then liberate these bioactive molecules that trigger cells at a distance to put the guards on the gate and to generate a phenotype of inflammation. Now, I've always wondered, and I'm sure you have as well, if tumor necrosis factor alpha is a central player in these inflammatory processes, we call that abbreviated TNF-alpha, if it's a central player, then you might say, well, gee, why don't we just develop an analysis for TNF-alpha? Why don't we then develop a broad-scale therapy to block TNF-alpha? Because that might be the easiest way of approaching the management or the first recognition and later management of these conditions. But if you ask that question a little farther, you might ask, is TNF-alpha signaling the same in every cell? In other words, is there only one TNF-alpha? Because we often make these things a little more simple than they really are in human physiology. So let me, if I can, address that question for you just for a second, because you have probably heard that there are pharmaceuticals that have been approved for the treatment of autoimmune disease, inflammatory arthritis, for instance, that are TNF-alpha blocking agents or modulate TNF-alpha, and we see good clinical outcome from those blocking agents, but we also see some potential adverse side effects that occur from those generalized blocking agents. So what's the story around TNF-alpha, first maybe as a biomarker, and secondly as a potential target for therapeutic intervention? And the best way that I can get to that is to cite what probably for most of you would be a very esoteric article that you wouldn't really necessarily read, but I hope I can demythologize this, that appeared in the Journal of Biological Chemistry this last year. And I'll just tell you the title, and I promise we'll speak about what it really means. It's entitled, Bruton's Tyrosine Kinase is Involved in the P65-Mediated Transactivation and Phosphorylation of P65 on serine 536 during NF-kappa B activation by lipopolysaccharide. Now, that probably is not the article you're going to gravitate to for light reading. But what is this all about? This appeared, by the way, in the Journal of Biological Chemistry, Volume 280, page 23496 in 2005. This is one of a whole series of articles that relates to this topic. So let me summarize what it really says. What has been identified is that NF-kappa B, as you probably recall, sits in the cytoplasm of cells in a dormant state, bound up with an inhibitor called inhibitor kappa B. And the I-kappa B, NF-kappa B complex is just quiescent in a non-activated cell state. When an alarm message arrives at the surface of a cell, coming from an outside message or something that would trigger an arousal of the inflammatory process, it's picked up at a membrane receptor on the outside of the cell, and it translates through a very complex network pathway called kinases, that message that then weaves its way through the membrane into the cytoplasm of the cell through a kind of a ping-pong game of kinase intracellular relay races, that are very specific for that message that came to the cell. So the message that comes from bacterial lipopolysaccharides might trigger a different ping-pong game into the cell cytoplasm than the message that came from an allergic response, or the message that came from a toxic metal, or the message that came from a xenobiotic. These would produce possibly different types of messages that ultimately arrive at this NF-kappa B, I-kappa B complex. Now what happens is, through a very sophisticated series of steps, again mediated by specific kinases like inhibitor kappa kinase alpha and beta, the I-kappa B is phosphorylated and it falls off the complex, and the NF-kappa B is liberated as a free NF-kappa B that travels to the nucleus. Now, so far everything sounds pretty good, right? The NF-kappa B is now in the nucleus, and its role is to sit down on the reporter genes in your genotype to activate the genes that are associated with inflammation. Okay, so far, everything good. You hope you're following. Now the question is, does that NF-kappa B, when liberated, always affect the same reporter genes in every cell so you get the same exact mechanism? And here's where the story gets interesting. The answer is no. Throughout all of this process that I've described, the translation of the initial message into the cytoplasm of the cell, the liberation of I-kappa B from NF-kappa B, the translocation of NF-kappa B to the nucleus, and then lastly, the sitting down of NF-kappa B onto the genome at specific loci that would upregulate the expression of the genes associated with inflammation, is a very site-specific and very environment-specific function. Therefore, a generalized NF-kappa B inhibitor may produce good and bad effects, because there are some cells in which NF-kappa B is playing a very important role in regulating function of the immune system. There are other cells in a person with autoimmune disease where NF-kappa B is excessively activated and its modulation would be beneficial in the outcome of the patient. But if you generally block all activity of NF-kappa B, you get no differentiation of the good from the bad. There are different sites on the NF-kappa B molecules that can be phosphorylated by different kinases under different environmental circumstances that then cause it to identify and associate itself with different reporter genes. So you would get a different outcome in those cells that lead to specificity. Now, what am I trying to give you an understanding here? What I'm trying to say is that this process is much more exquisitely complex than we have dumbed it down to be. The reason for that, in a teleological argument, if I can be so bold as to suggest an argument, is that if we had only one path to NF-kappa B, and if NF-kappa B is the path to all inflammation, and every time we were associated with a pro-inflammatory, every cell in the body that has NF-kappa B in it, which are all cells, would become inflamed. And you know, clinically, that's just not what works, right? You know that a patient doesn't necessarily have every cell of their body inflamed when they're associated with a pro-inflammatory agent. They generally have cell-specific types of inflammation. But if we use a general NF-kappa B inhibitor, it doesn't matter if NF-kappa B is working in a favorable way to modulate immune function or in a dysfunctional way to enhance inflammation, all of those processes would be blocked. This is a little bit like the argument of the COX-1 and COX-2 with the selective COX-2 inhibitors that we learned later produce some adverse effects on the favorable effects of COX-2 on the vascular endothelium. So how does the natural system work? It works by very tight regulation of these cell signaling mechanisms through these kinases to regulate only certain cells that need to alter their NF-kappa B activation of reporter genes to produce then specific types of cytokines. If you could imagine this from a therapeutic approach, what you would really like to have is biomarkers that would identify what specific pathway within the NF-kappa B cascade was associated with what specific dysfunction that will later lead to a disease, not just general NF-kappa B dysfunction. So you wouldn't necessarily just measure TNF-alpha, which comes off of the gene expression of activation by NF-kappa B. You would want to know what cells are activated by specific types of cell signaling from NF-kappa B that produce then TNF-alpha, and you'd want to regulate your therapy specific to the biomarker that's associated with that process of activation of TNF-alpha. Now let me try this again so you understand where I'm going. Where I'm going is to say TNF-alpha is kind of generic. We don't know what cell it came from. All we know is that certain cell types were activated into inflammation through NF-kappa B activation of the reporter genes to produce TNF-alpha, and that that came through upregulation through kinases that were unique to that cell line. And what we'd like to know is, what specifically do I need to modulate to target that cell line or that tissue type without just a general suppression of all forms of NF-kappa B activation of immune function? Now, that's a new pharmacology, isn't it? That really leads to personalized medicine. So what kind of biomarkers might emerge from this concept or this objective? Biomarkers that would identify the individual kinase pathways that are associated with the individual tissue regulation of inflammation and immunity. Now, in oncology, which is a good example of how this is being harnessed, there are those types of things that are happening with specific tissue kinases in which, in the laboratory, tissues are being taken on biopsy and they're analyzed in that patient for specific mutated kinases that are unique to that patient. And then a therapy is delivered that will focus on that kinase, not just a general kinase inhibitor, because if you use a general kinase inhibitor in that patient, they'll die, because kinases are very important for the regulation of all sorts of important immune functions. But if you target on that mutant kinase that's associated with that altered cell function that gives rise to that malignancy in that individual patient, you have a higher biological basis for outcome in cancer therapy. That's personalized medicine, right, in the oncology realm. And that's actually being done now with a number of the new oncology drugs, that particular strategy. That strategy, to me, is aligned with where functional medicine is going around a whole series of other disorders. And those disorders are associated with a variety of complex chronic diseases. If we could start identifying those specific regulators of tissue-specific activation and then the molecules that would be useful for normalizing their function. I hope I haven't lost you here, but I think you'll learn more of this when you hear our Researcher of the Month speak, because that's kind of the strategy that you can see happening as it relates to how the environment modulates function. Maybe we've been modulating our function from time immemorial through all the things we're exposed to, through these subtle alteration of these cell-specific kinase pathways that regulate our function in appropriate or inappropriate ways. So maybe toxic foods, toxic environments, toxic thoughts, all these things then create a dysfunction in kinase signaling that are specific to certain cell types that give rise to different types of diseases. Now let me close this argument with a less esoteric and a more specific clinical example. Those of you that have been following our discussion of autoimmune disease know that I have proposed a model. It's actually not my model. It comes from the literature, so I can't claim this was invented here, but it's communicated here. And that is that autoimmune disease is a consequence of building up responses to foreign agents in our body that were really a part of the normal immune function of the body. Our body's immune system is there to respond to foreign substances. And so what happens if our host, friendly cells, become foreign cells? And then the body's immune system does what it's supposed to do. It forms an antibody or a protective factor or a destructive factor against that foreign substance. Now you might say, well, how could our body go from being a friend to being a foe? I mean, what would do that? And then I went through a whole list of things like damage to proteins or damage to DNA by radiation or chemicals or various cell physiological mechanisms that could take a host friendly cell and make it into a foreign molecule, like a foreign protein that had a different amino acid, an oxidized or a glycated amino acid, or a phosphorylated amino acid that looks not like the host anymore. And a very adept immune system that's on a seek and destroy mechanism would say, aha, foreigner on board, I'm going to produce something against it to get rid of it. That's called an autoantibody. So you might say, is there evidence for this model? And of course there is. I've cited numerous studies that have come in the literature showing that DNA autoantibodies are often not to host DNA, they're to alter DNA. We call them anti-nuclear antibodies, but they're actually anti-nuclear altered DNA antibodies. So then you say, well, what about the connection of estrogen to autoimmune disease? An interesting connection. It's a most female-connected disease, but we know that oral contraceptives are often used to treat things like SLE, so it sounds like estrogen is beneficial. We know that women that are pregnant who have autoimmune diseases that often gets in remission during their pregnancy say, oh, estrogen sounds good. But then we also know that women who are postmenopausal and get autoimmune disease often have some dysfunction in estrogen metabolism, or menstruating women often have a flare during their time of the menstrual period when they have autoimmune disease. So this doesn't all seem to fit. It seems inconsistent clinically. Well, then I raise the question, are we sure that these conditions that are associated with estrogen are associated with 17-beta-estradiol and not altered estrogen, the estrogen metabolites, the funny molecules that can cause clastogenic or mutagenic influences on DNA and other molecules? In other words, the twisted estrogen molecules like the 16-hydroxyestrogen or the 4-hydroxyestrogens. And I raise the question that maybe we're looking in the wrong place. Maybe it's the altered estrogen metabolites that are associated with exacerbation of autoimmune disease. And from that, then, I reported a clinical study that was published in 2001 in the journal Lupus that indicated that supplementation with indole-3-carbinol in women with SLE actually led to improvement of their symptoms and increasing their 2-to-16-hydroxyestrogen ratios. Now, I'd like to throw one last concept to you, and that is this is a wonderful paper in the journal Nutrition entitled Lifespan is Prolonged in Autoimmune-Prone Mice, the NZB mice, the SLE animal model for SLE. These were fed a diet supplemented with indole-3-carbinol, a phytonutrient that you know is increasing the 2-hydroxylation at the expense of lowering the 4-and-16-hydroxylation, so it's improving estrogen metabolism. And what did they find? I won't go through the whole study. This is Journal of Nutrition, Volume 133, page 3610 in 2003. They found that the estrogen urinary metabolite ratio of 2-to-16 was increased in the indole-3-carbinol-fed mice, and they had a profound effect on experimental SLA. They had a remission of symptoms. They didn't have death, which they had in the animals that were not I3C supplemented. The point I'm trying to lead you to is we are looking for biomarkers that sometimes are way away from what you might think is the origin of the disease. The 2 to 16 hydroxyestrogen ratio you might not think is a biomarker for autoimmune disease, but it may be in specific women who have estrogen exacerbation of their symptoms. And for them, phytonutrient supplementation with 200 to 400 milligrams of indole-3-carbinol a day and following their 2:16 hydroxyestrogen ratio may be very beneficial in ameliorating the course of their disease. Obviously, indole-3-carbinol comes from the cruciferous vegetables, the broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, Brussels sprout family. So does this say that there are certain foods that might be beneficial for the amelioration of autoimmune disease? A big question that we're going to share with our researcher of the month, Dr. John Bright. Well, once again, we're at that portion of the monthly functional medicine update that I think we all are very excited to hear about from the mouths of the people that are really making this field evolve, and that's the clinicians and researchers of the month. And this month we have Dr. John J. Bright, who is a senior investigator and director of Neuroscience Research Lab at Methodist Research Institute of Clarion Health in Indianapolis, Indiana. Before joining as the Director of Neuroscience Research, the Methodist Research Institute, Dr. Bright was at the Department of Neurology and Pharmacology at the Vanderbilt University School of Medicine in Nashville, Tennessee. And I was struck by his work going through some abstracts related to autoimmune disease and found that his studies in the neuroscience and in the pharmacology of autoimmune disease seemed to be very pioneering. And then lo and behold, as I was following the track of his research, I determined that he was also looking at the role that various nutraceuticals and plant-based materials have on the immunological system pertaining specifically to autoimmune disease. So it was a fascinating kind of circular connection that I came to reading his work. And I think his studies are very exacting, very precise, and some very interesting science. And I'd like to first introduce Dr. Bright to you, the audience of Functional Medicine Update. So, Dr. Bright, thank you for being with us today and sharing your very interesting work.
Thank you, Dr. Bland. I'm glad that I could share some of our studies that we have done in autoimmune disease that may benefit many millions of people who are suffering because of that autoimmune disease. Autoimmunity is a process in our body that usually immune system take care of our body, and our body has been evolved to fight against infection. And at some point, due to some unknown reasons, this immune response damages our own tissues, and they are normally called as autoimmune diseases. This autoimmune response attacking individual specific organs like heart or brain and pancreas leads to specific diseases including multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, and type 1 diabetes, myocarditis. There are many autoimmune diseases which affects our human health, and there are no one hypothesis or theory that explains how these diseases are happening. But one thing we know, there is immune response against our tissues or cells. We use one animal model for multiple sclerosis, that is called the EAE or experimental allergic encephalomyelitis, to learn the pathogenesis mechanisms in this disease process, and also to test different molecules or drugs which may be useful to treat multiple sclerosis or any other autoimmune diseases. And EAE is a mouse model that we use. You can induce in different animal models, but our experiments mostly are in mouse model. We induce this disease by injecting neural antigens or proteins from brain, purified or synthesized in the lab, and then inject two times usually, or we call it as vaccination. Two vaccination leads to development of the disease like multiple sclerosis. And we score those animals by looking at clinical symptoms of paralysis. Usually the paralysis in these mice starts from tail, and we call those paralysis in the tail is score one, and then it progresses towards anteriorly. If the paralysis we see in tail and hind limb, that will be score 2, and it goes up to both hind limbs, it will be score 3, and tail, both hind limbs and forelimbs will be score 4, and if the animals cannot move or animals die, that will be score 5. And we use this kind of scoring system in the disease as well as after treatment or before treatment, we'll compare and how the scores changes. And by using different mouse strains, we can induce different types of disease. There are two main types of multiple sclerosis we see in human beings. One is relapsing remitting type and chronic progressive. Those are two types. And we use SJL type of mice to induce relapsing remitting disease, and they get better after 25 to 30 days. So the whole disease process of our experimental course is something like 0 to 30 days. When we induce the disease, we usually score these animals clinically, as well as we take immune cells from those animals and put it in culture and try to learn the mechanisms, how these drugs regulate these immune or autoimmune cells in culture. And then we go after learning a little more mechanistically by looking at the specific signaling pathways that is blocked or regulated by these drugs, so that we can define the mechanism of the drug effect in these animals. And we initially started looking at one cytokine called interleukin-12 that is produced usually by macrophages, microglia, or dendritic cells in our body. Microglia is macrophage-like cells present only in the brain. And we found that if you induce the disease in this EAE model, these levels of IL-12 goes higher. It follows higher during the disease is higher and then comes back when the disease goes away by treatment or even otherwise. We thought the IL-12 is a good candidate to follow through, and then we treated those animals with anti-IL-12 antibody, neutralizing antibody, that is against a P40 subunit that is very important in this disease process. So if you neutralize IL-12, you can inhibit the disease. That was our earlier finding, then realized that IL-12 is a major player in this disease process. And then IL-12 gene expression or IL-12 induced function are the two aspects we wanted to study. And the IL-12 functions means IL-12 acts on T cells to make them cells that can induce the disease. We call this encephalitogenic T cells. And those are mostly CD4 positive T cells. And IL-12 induces Th1 or T helper 1 type encephalitogenic T cells by signaling through a pathway called JAK-STAT pathway. JAK-STAT, JAK for Janus kinase, STAT for signal transducer and activator of transcription. So that is a signaling pathway that IL-12 induces to make Th1 type or encephalitogenic T cells in EAE. And what we later on did was that we took a compound that people have shown that it inhibits inflammation, and that is compound that binds on PPAR gamma. PPAR gamma, or peroxisome proliferator activated receptor gamma, is a member of the family of nuclear receptors. These proteins proceed in the nuclear membrane, and if you cross-link with a ligand that gets activated and inhibits inflammation, that was the overall understanding of this molecule. And a synthetic ligand for PPAR gamma has been used as a treatment for diabetes. That is a prescription drug, FDA-approved drug for diabetes even now. So we took those. There are natural ligands for PPAR gamma. There are synthetic ligands for PPAR gamma. In our earlier experiments, we took those natural and synthetic compounds of the PPAR gamma ligand family and treated these animals after inducing the disease, EAE. And we found that these two, both natural and synthetic compounds, can inhibit EAE in a dose-dependent manner. Then we went on to look at the mechanism of action. We found that it inhibits IL-12 production as well as IL-12 signaling through JAK-STAT pathway. That was our finding at that time, and it was not just a drug effect. We used knockout animals. A homozygous knockout for PPAR gamma protein is embryonically lethal. So we used a wild type and a heterozygous animal for PPAR gamma, and then we showed if you knock out part of that PPAR gamma function, those disease in EAE disease is severe. If the PPAR gamma activity is low, the disease is higher, showing that it has a physiological function in the normal EAE process. We believe that this may be true in human MS as well, that PPAR gamma is really playing a role in regulating the disease process there. And we have followed upon that with our interest in nuclear receptor family of proteins. Then we started looking at different molecule called vitamin D. Vitamin D has been shown its involvement in regulating immune responses. And we believe that because MS-like diseases are more common in the colder region where vitamin D has more levels, that sunlight is required for its synthesis. We tested an active metabolite of vitamin D. It's 125-dihydroxyvitamin D3. We treated animals after inducing EAE MS-like disease, treated with vitamin D, and it protects animals from getting EAE. And again, in this experiment also, we went on to look at its mechanism of action that involves inhibition of IL-12 production as well as IL-12-induced function in immune cells. So with this background, then we realized that there are so many natural compounds out there that may function like these compounds. And with the knowledge that many of the natural compounds, nutraceuticals or phytochemicals, have anti-inflammatory properties, we have selected some of those molecules. Most favorite for us is curcumin, and the second one is quercetin. Quercetin is a phytoestrogen. It comes from these kind of compounds or flavonoid compounds are rich in soybean, many fruits and vegetables. And we used in our experiment very purified, pure compound quercetin, and we injected into mouse models of MS, and we showed that if you treat with these kind of compounds, it can inhibit the development of the disease. And the second set of compounds we used is the curcumin. Curcumin is a powder or extracted compound from a plant called turmeric. It's an underground stem or rhizome. You can purify it. Usually it's an yellow-colored powder. People use it in Asian countries as a spice to color the food products, and people use it in very low quantity in their daily menu, in their food. People used in ancient days, and you know, so many years in the ancient countries, curcumin for wound healing or inflammation kind of diseases. And we took that curcumin and injected into EAE animal. We have dosed 100 and 200 microgram or 50 and 100 microgram, different doses. On every other day, IP injections in our animal, we found that curcumin inhibits dose-dependently the EAE disease in mouse model, suggesting that it may be used for treating multiple sclerosis. And we found there are different mechanisms involved in it. At least one mechanism for curcumin inhibition of EAE is by inhibiting IL-12 production as well as IL-12 signaling through JAK-STAT pathway. We found these compounds are very interesting, especially curcumin. There are few reports recently came that curcumin can also bind on PPAR gamma. So there are connections between these compounds. Otherwise, we don't know how curcumin inhibits JAK or STAT pathway. At least we know if curcumin binds on PPAR gamma, that PPAR gamma may be able to interact with the JAK-STAT pathway and downregulate that signaling pathway, leading to Th1 differentiation or encephalogenic T cell development in this EAE model. And there may be so many other compounds like that out there which may be useful, but we need to study more about the use of these compounds, and we need to study its side effects. Usually we believe these are natural compounds with very less side effects, and hopefully these kind of compounds will reach patients for their benefit. We need to study more. It needs more funding support for conducting these kind of research to further understand its mechanism of action in the safety and efficacy in human being as well. And believe that these natural compounds are very important to study and will reach human patients for their benefit.
Dr. Bright, I want to just congratulate you. That was one of the most remarkable, eloquent, and fluent descriptions of a very complex topic by connecting together a tremendous amount of information in a way that was really quite incredible. Obviously, you've practiced that before, but more than that, that is a very thoughtful way that you articulated that to our listeners. I'd like to go back, if I could, and pick up some of the high spots, because many of our listeners are not as familiar with molecular biology or some of these signal transduction mechanisms as a specialist such as you in neurosciences. If you wouldn't mind, I want to emphasize a few of the points by just taking us through some of the things that you said. Let's start, if we could, by just addressing the question that I think a lot of people often have about animal models. How respected is the EAE animal model to correlate with human disease in the autoimmune area, the MS area? Is it a generally accepted model that has a pretty strong human clinical correlation with its pathophysiology?
I believe this is the best model what we have so far available for studying the MS pathogenesis or therapeutic aspects, and there are controversies, there are differences, and even if you see MS patients, the disease is different between patients. So there is no uniform pattern of disease, but overall there are two classifications of relapsing, remitting, or chronic progressive. And even if you see the lesions, there is no clear pattern of lesions. Each individual look differently. There are two, three manuscripts, review articles published about opinion about the use of EAE as a model. There are confusions about it. If you see those recent review articles on EAE as a useful model or not for MS studies, I think most of the comments come as this is the best model you have. Until we know there is another better model than this, I think we need to continue using this model, because this is the model that we have so far used to test and find a useful drug for MS. So any FDA-approved drug now we have for treatment for MS in the market are the drugs tested and approved based on the results we found in EAE.
That's great. That really answers that beautifully. Now, in past editions of Functional Medicine Update, we've interviewed two investigators that have some overlap with your areas of emphasis, and that's Dr. Colleen Hayes at University of Wisconsin and Dr. Michael Hollick at Boston University Medical School. You probably know Dr. Hayes' work at the University of Wisconsin on vitamin D metabolites and MS, and also Mike Hollick, who was originally at Wisconsin and was one of the discoverers, I believe, of the 1,25-dihydroxy-D3 before he moved on to dermatology and immunology at BU.
Yeah.
And I think their work very closely affiliates itself and certainly is consistent with your observations. Have you had communication with either Dr. Hayes or Hollick over your years?
Not really. I know their work, and I strongly believe their observations are real, and it has been confirmed in our studies. I believe that our studies have added one step further, showing that the effect of vitamin D3 can also mechanistically, by inhibiting the JAK-STAT pathway, we have proven that pathway is also important in the disease pathogenesis. So we have added at least one step further in the understanding of its mechanism of action.
Yes, I think that's what I was going to reinforce, that one of the questions that has been raised at meetings that I've attended that Dr. Hayes or Dr. Hollick has presented is, okay, you've got some very compelling evidence but no mechanism as to how it works, and your work really has started to piece together the mechanism through these kinase signaling pathways, and I think is a big step forward in people starting to recognize the importance that these agonists for JAK-STAT have and how it influences IL-12 and downregulates TH1 activity. So very big step forward. When we look at autoimmune disease, often people say, in the absence of high autoantibody titers, there is no clinical autoimmune disease. From your evaluation of both the literature and your experience, are autoantibodies a sine qua non for the autoimmune process, and how do they derive out of the signaling activation that you've described?
You know, in the early days, people were working mostly on T cell as the target for inhibiting diseases, mostly autoimmune diseases. And we now know definitely antibodies will play a role. Antibodies are playing a role, and autoantibodies will be playing a role. Still, we call these MS, RA, rheumatoid arthritis, type 1 diabetes, uveitis, myocarditis as T-cell mediated disease, mostly Th1 type cell mediated disease. But during the course of analysis, we and others people have found that antibodies specific to neural antigens are present in MS as well as in this animal model. But my point is that even to produce autoantibodies by B cells require TH1 cells. TH1 means T helper cells. Helper cells help B cells also to make antibodies. So even though B cells are involved, T cells are the prime target, and if we target TH1 cells, it will inhibit TH1 cell mediated tissue damage as well as its help to B cells. So it will be the best target, I think, to go after.
Yeah, that makes very good sense. And it's interesting, there's more literature coming out now saying that autoantibodies are there always at some level of importance, or part of the body's defense process, are not all bad. A zero titer of autoantibodies is not associated with good health, and it relates to the distribution of the type of immunoglobulins, that if you shift a pattern from an IgG dominant over to an IgM dominant, that suggests that you're getting a shift in the personality of your immune system moving towards autoimmunity. So I find it fascinating that we've kind of changed our view about autoantibodies, saying they're not all bad. They're actually part of the natural defense process.
That's what I also believe, that it's part of the natural defense process as well. It's not basically blocking or inhibiting antibody or TH1 response is important. We need to regulate in a threshold where it won't cause any harm to our tissues, but it will maintain and regulate what regular physiological functions needs to be taken care of.
Thank you. So the next question is, I know, a very controversial question, and that is, if autoantibody titers start increasing well before the diagnosis of disease, and I think there's ample evidence for that published in some fairly good journals like New England Journal of Medicine a couple of years ago, then it suggests that there is a preclinical stage of autoimmune disease that may exist prior to the onset of a frank diagnosis. Does your work through looking at the signaling mechanism suggest that early on, if we had proper biomarkers, we could identify the trajectory towards autoimmunity if we could ask the right question?
We believe in that kind of pattern as well. In our animal experiment, that is a 30-day course of experiment, usually the disease peak goes around 12 to 15 days. We did a course of real PCR analysis of the IL-12 gene expression in the brain. We found that we can detect high level of IL-12 around 6 to 7 days, 5 to 8 days is the peak. It's coming higher. So that is actually, we call it as pre-disease as well. If that is the case, I think we don't get to do similar kind of analysis in human MS patients, but we believe that this pattern may be seen in human as well if we get, now it's hard to identify such a patients before they come to clinic. So if there is such a study, we believe that we may be able to identify pre-disease increase in pathogenic antibodies as well as the cytokine level.
I think that's a very important message for our clinicians to keep in mind, because it's been suggested that there are approximately fivefold as many people that have increasing titers of autoantibody prior to the onset of diagnosis than there are people being treated for frank autoimmune disease. So if you consider that there are 3 to 4 million people with various autoimmune diseases, and you multiply that by 5, it's a substantial portion of the population actually that has a chronic state of immune imbalance that we might call preclinical autoimmunity, for which the drugs that are used to treat autoimmune disease are probably too harsh. So then the question is what to do with these patients to improve their function. And obviously then some of your investigations and discoveries related to some of these natural products may come into play, because that may be the best compounds in an earlier stage for modulating these functions.
We believe so, that natural compounds may play a very important role because of its less side effects. We believe so that you can start even taking lower quantities even if you don't have a disease. If you think a pre-disease stage, that you may be able to substantially the possibility of getting, you know, clinical disease. One thing we need to keep in mind, that most of our studies used higher doses of these molecules we use to inhibit the disease after the onset of disease or during the course of induction of disease. So usually these nutraceuticals, people eat very low quantities in their regular diets. And if we keep doing that routinely, like people do in some of the Asian countries, we may be able to prevent the onset of these kind of autoimmune diseases.
So that then bears on another question. We know that in the United States and elsewhere in the developed world, we have this rising tide of insulin resistance, hyperinsulinemia, and type 2 diabetes. And your work on recognizing that there is a connection between PPAR gamma agonists and the downregulation through the JAK-STAT pathway of IL-12 expression suggests, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, I guess this is a question, suggests that there may be a correlation between insulin resistance, hyperinsulinemia, alterations in the PPAR gamma pathway, and exacerbation of inflammatory types of autoimmunity. Does that story that I've just developed hold any water, or is that making too many leaps?
That is something we want to study as well. We are trying to see what we, all our experiments with PPAR gamma ligands are in an animal model, and we know these drugs are taken as a drug for type 2 diabetes, as a prescription drug. We are trying to see, at least in the record, we can find some MS patients who are type 2 diabetic and they are prescribed for taking the PPAR gamma ligands, and if we can find some number of patients like that, whether they do better or they get worse, what is the relationship between taking PPAR gamma ligands and then MS or diabetes, how we can connect it. But we know at this point that PPAR gamma ligands definitely inhibit JAK-STAT pathway. Some of that pathways are required for fighting infection, because we need to see that IL-12 is very essential for Th1 response, and Th1 response is required for fighting against many of the pathogens. So we cannot shut down the whole pathway of Th1 response, because then patients need to live in intensive cares and, you know, in the sterile environment. So our objective is to regulate these pathways so that it can come to a threshold level of autoimmune response which won't harm the tissue, but it will be the immune response to infection will be available. So JAK-STAT pathway is a target. We think it is one among the least pathway that these kind of molecules are targeting. We need to remember that these pathways are required for normal physiological function as well.
Well, you just said something that I think is, again, very important for our clinicians. The drugs, the breakthrough new biologicals that we have available to the rheumatologist to manage autoimmune disease are these biotech products that are basically anti-TNF-alpha blocking agents, or they're mimics that bind to receptors. So in that case, because of the physiological activity of these compounds, they're capable of really suppressing the immune system. And then, of course, the black box label warnings for these products often say things like, we should be concerned about tuberculosis, or we should be concerned about maybe malignancy. So what I'm hearing from you is that we have to be cautious when we use these very dramatic drugs, in that they may have an effect on suppressing immune systems. So if we could early intervene, we may get some advantage, some clinical advantage.
That is what my point to stress in every manuscript when we write in the conclusion. I put a warning like that, that we need to watch the dose we use when we take these drugs, because all these pathways we show are important for our normal physiology and fighting against infection or cancer. The timing is very important. I think if we start taking before we get the disease earlier on in the lower levels or a normal dietary level of these compounds, may be beneficial in the long run.
So with that, I'm going to give our listeners the titles of four of your papers that I think bear on the next question I want to ask you. Just they'll have that in their thoughts. One is your more recent paper in the Journal of Neuroscience Research, which is volume 83, page 1299 in 2006, entitled 1,25-dihydroxy-D3 modulating the JAK-STAT pathway and IL-12 INF-gamma axis leading to the Th1 response in EAE. The next is quercetin. This comes from the Journal of Clinical Immunology, volume 24, page 542 in 2004. Quercetin, a flavonoid phytoestrogen, ameliorating experimental AEA by blocking IL-12 signaling through the JAK-STAT pathway in the T-lymphocyte. And the next is this curcumin and autoimmune disease study, curcumin inhibiting experimental AEA by blocking IL-12 signaling through Janus kinase STAT pathway in T lymphocytes. This appeared in the Journal of Immunology, volume 169. This is 2002, page 6506. And then your review paper, targeting autoimmune diseases through nutraceuticals, which appeared in the Journal Nutrition, volume 20, page 39 in 2004. Now, with that as a background, just so our listeners know that you're speaking as an expert, I'd like to ask a kind of a philosophical question, and that is, I've always wondered why it is that within the cellular signaling pathways, these antennae that stick out to receive messages from the outside world, which kinases then translate to internal cellular phenotypic response in terms of changing the personality of the cell. So they are like receptors out there that are sensing the outside world and translating those messages through these kinases, these complex networks of signaling, to the gene to create different expression patterns that change the personality of that cell to go from a cell at rest, say, to a cell that's in an inflammation state. Why it is that specific nutrients seem that we've either consumed or been exposed to, like 1,25-dihydroxy-D3 or curcuminoids or quercetin, would influence those pathways? Philosophically, what does this mean about what we've eaten and the environments we live and the regulation of our gene expression patterns and the changing environment that then maps against the diseases that we've seen in prevalence in developed Western society? Do you philosophically feel that there's some interesting connection here?
I think so. First of all, you know, I appreciate introducing some of our published manuscripts here with the titles and volumes. We are glad that we could make some lead on publishing some of the use of these nutraceuticals for the autoimmune diseases. The curcumin is one and favorite for us that when we presented in a conference in New Orleans several years back, Reuters Health wrote an article about it that curry spice can cure multiple sclerosis. That was the title. And there was a lot of attention and many patients started calling me how many teaspoons I can eat. And then Multiple Sclerosis Society called me and asked me to send a PDF form of that to put in their website because many patients are calling and asking about it. I, at that time, cautioned many of the patients that this is an animal study and this is a compound we usually use at very low quantities in our daily food, and that may normal, it may regulate normal physiology. But in the disease conditions, we may have to dose and learn maybe with more clinical trials in human MS before we can say how much teaspoons we can eat. That is a caution, again, I'm telling. But this is a beauty that we believe that no human being can survive or live without food. So everybody is eating food and everybody is getting some kind of nutraceuticals, biologically active, functional molecules through food every day in our life. For example, curcumin, people have been eating from childhood to adult. But through these studies, at least we could understand one mechanism by which some of these nutraceuticals regulate our body functions. And even though environmental factors, and we sometimes wonder why they regulate our molecular mechanisms in our immune system especially, this is one proof that we have shown that JAK-STAT pathway can be regulated by natural products or nutraceuticals or environmental factors. I think that is an interplay between environment and the autoimmune disease. When we talk about autoimmune disease, we don't know the etiology yet. And we believe that environment is one factor which modulates genetic and our behavioral things. So nutraceuticals, you can call this behavioral. You choose what you eat. So your choice of food can change the final outcome of your health through autoimmune diseases or otherwise. So we believe that nutraceuticals or natural products or environment can influence molecular mechanisms or physiology of your life or the life processes which lead to pathogenesis of many diseases, including autoimmune disease.
That's a really eloquent answer. I have one last question. We could go on for infinitely long. This is such a fascinating topic, but I'll restrain myself and just ask one last question, and that is, it seems what's emerging from your work and work of others that these environmental factors that signal certain cellular functions through these kinase pathways operate through very complex web-like signaling pathways. And that then suggests that there's more than one mechanism for controlling a disease. A disease is not just the breakdown of one mechanism, and that maybe there's the possibility of synergy among these different compounds that are consumed in a daily diet or that we are exposed to in our environment. And it's not just one molecule at a time, but rather it's multiple pathways responding to multiple molecules that give rise to the orchestration that we call our function. this is a very different model, obviously, than the traditional pharmacological model, which is one molecule for one function for one disease. So I wonder, do you feel that as this emerges, this concept of regulators of intercellular communication from the environment, that we will start looking more at complex arrays of molecules affecting multiple pathways?
I believe so. It's not one pathway. We believe JAK-STAT is one pathway. We know there are many other pathways involved in the whole process of autoimmune response, autoimmune disease, and inflammation. Pathways like ERK, MAP kinase pathway, NF-kappa B pathway, AKT pathway, JAK's pathway. There are so many signaling pathways. I think there is a network among these pathways that leads to the final outcome of the disease. But we believe that if we can block one of these pathways, means it will block the whole network. So every pathway is important. We are trying to learn one pathway at a time. And we have recently started up with a computer program we use to map all the pathways involved in autoimmune disease using inflammation and EAE and EMS as a model, and to locate novel targets in various different pathways and how they interact and what are the directionality of the interaction and the strength of the interaction, so that we can identify novel molecular targets at the junctions of these pathways. There are many approaches like that I think people are taking, hopefully not like the single drug therapy. We believe that nutraceuticals have multiple biologically active functional compounds in that, so they may all work together in concert to regulate these signaling pathways. One example is that curcumin has a low bioavailability. That is one complaint we have. So if you say that piperine or piperacin, there is a compound that if you put together, people have published that curcumin's bioavailability can be increased by other compounds. So what we realize from these kind of experiments is that even one natural or phytochemical or nutraceutical compound can increase the other compound's bioavailability or its action on one pathway. So even the biomolecules or nutraceuticals help each other to enhance its activity on the molecular targets, as well as the molecular signaling pathways also work in concert. So these nutraceuticals may help regulate all these networks together, these molecules together regulating the network of signaling pathways in a beneficial way for human health.
Well, Dr. Bright, I wanted to compliment you. This has been one of the most information-dense and concentrated but eloquent presentations that we've been fortunate enough to have, and it opens up a whole vision of where our future might be taking us in looking at the role that diet and lifestyle and environment play in both the prevention and management of complex chronic disease. So keep up the tremendous work. You're really a pioneer, and we've so appreciated you sharing this information with us.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bland, for the opportunity to share our work, and hope we will have more and more discussions like that, and some of this message will be useful and beneficial for the patients who are suffering due to autoimmune diseases. Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, I'm guilty for waxing very philosophical at times and getting very emotive and excited about these interviews, but I think my excitement is very justified in the conclusion of Dr. Bright's eloquent presentation, because these implications of what he's discussed may be quite dramatic clinically. And that is, if you recall, Dr. Colleen Hayes from the University of Wisconsin, when she talked about her work animal model, EAE model for MS, showed that vitamin D metabolite, the 1,25-dihydroxy-D3, when instilled directly into the brains of these totally paralyzed animals, in a matter of less than a half an hour, were up walking and then running around the cages. So the dramatic influence of these agonists that may have nutritional origin could be quite significant clinically, and obviously the chapter still remains to be fully written, but the story sounds very fascinating from a clinical perspective. Thanks for being with us. We look forward to being with you next month.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by Synthesis LLC by Dr. Jeffrey Blank. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.